Hi, I'm Jen Suliafu, and I'm delighted to be on this journey with you. Life is an exciting game with many twists and turns. It gets really good when we begin to learn how it works and how to win. I believe that no matter where someone's life is at, we have the power to make radical shifts to create a life that truly honors us. I live for awakenings, so let's get to it, darlings. Hey everyone, welcome back. Oh my gosh. You guys, I'm so looking forward to today's episode. About a month ago, I turned on my TV and there was a news segment on. And anyone that knows me knows that I despise the news. And I always say, don't watch the news, turn it off. It's a bunch of shenanigans. But this was different. I totally feel like I was supposed to see this segment. I turned it on and all of a sudden, I saw Paris Hilton. She was just starting her testimony in Utah. There was a program that she went through years ago in Utah, which is where I'm based. And she was testifying against the troubled teen industry and the things that had happened with her and her experience. And I was in awe of what she was saying. It really, really hit me and struck me. And so I continued to watch. And then she finished, and you could tell that she was nervous. She was definitely kind of quiet. But then afterwards, next up was this amazing powerhouse, badass, force to be reckoned with woman named Caroline Lorson. And I was like, who is this woman? Because she just was like so strong, sat down there, told her testimony, and I was just really, really struck by her. So what an honor to have her here with me today and talk to you. So welcome, Caroline.
Hello, everyone. I am so excited to speak with all of you. And Jen, thank you so much for having me on today. Yes. Utah was a roller coaster, and there's been so much that's happened since that hearing, which was last month on the 8th. So yeah, you're right, just about a month ago. I will catch you up on all the details, I promise. I will not spare you any of the juiciness. I will totally let you know what's happened.
Well, the thing I was so struck with you, so I'm in awe of all of you, because I know there are many of you and you're very, very strong. Even the guy, the gentleman that went after you, is just like so heartfelt and just beautiful. But one thing that was intriguing about you, and we'll definitely get to that, but I could tell that you have done a lot of work. I could tell that you've done a lot of healing. There was also a lot of stuff that you got emotional, but you were so strong. As I was watching you, it was like, this woman was born for this. In this moment, like she was born to come and step into this activism, this role to help all of these other kids and these teens. And I know some people are probably lost of what we're talking about. We'll get to that in a minute. But basically what I had done is you struck me in such a huge way with your strength that you had. You looked the cameras in the eye and you spoke directly with a lot of force behind that, and strength and power, more power behind it than force, right?
You know, it was interesting because I don't know if to anyone listening, if you guys have ever done any kind of performing or dance. I used to do dance when I was younger and competitive cheerleading and all those kinds of things. And there's always that feeling when you have a competition and you're about to go on and you're standing there in line and it's like, all of a sudden, everything goes silent. You forget your lines. You forget the moves. Like it just like you cannot tangibly comprehend what the next step is. But then once you get out there on the floor and you hear the music start or you hear the presenter invite you on stage and you just know like it's go time, right? And that's exactly what I experienced in that moment. I was relatively nervous going in. But right before I sat down to testify, and we were in the Judiciary Committee in the Senate in Utah, and right before I sat down, I just had this feeling that I'm not only here representing myself, I am here representing thousands of people who have been through this experience. And I felt like I owed it to them to have that power behind my voice and not flake out and get nervous. And so, yeah, it was an incredible experience. And as you said, we can get more into the backstory because there's a lot to it. But the response from the senators is what really choked me up. Luckily, I was off camera at that point because I was steamy tears and just, you know, a lot of emotion that day. But I appreciate that you tuned into the hearing. It was a monumental moment and really actually history making. So,
yeah. And I felt that I normally just turn the news like as soon as I see it. But I like stopped and I was just like, whoa. And I even pulled it up later and was like telling my husband, hey, honey, I want you to watch this, like this happened. And then I thought about it throughout the night. I even woke up in the middle of the night. And the next morning I woke up and I was having coffee with my husband. And I was like, why is this getting to me so much? Why am I so struck by this story and this whole scenario? Why? I realized it was because I get so fired up anytime things happen with kids or teens, and it's definitely my passion. And I realized it's because I didn't feel safe a lot as a child. And so even though I did not have that experience and it wasn't the same thing, it hit me, it like reached in and shook me. And so that's why I immediately reached out to you and was like, girlfriend, let's talk. I want you on my show. I want to be a part of helping get this message out and having this dialogue because it is so important. And when you said that you realized, you know, going in there, you not only were doing this for yourself, but all of these other people that have gone through the program, what I thought even take a bigger step forward is all the other kids that could go through the program or would go through in the future as well. It's like you're talking about a massive amount of people that you were speaking on behalf for, right?
Oh, absolutely. It's like that infinity loop, right? We have all the people who had been through these programs, all the people who could ever go through these programs. And I sat down and was thinking about our movement a couple weeks ago. And I realized I want to give credit where credit is due. There are definitely other advocacy groups, although they might be a little bit smaller than our group. And to my knowledge, I'm not aware of anyone who is really making the legislative movements that we are. And so I felt this like deep personal responsibility to see this through. Right? This is something that I'm going to show up for every single day because I have to. And I want to as well, but there's that sense of responsibility, right? I have to communicate this to people. I have the connections. I have the resources. Lawmakers are listening. Celebrities are getting involved. And we've created this massive movement. And really, we've only just started. So there's a deep sense of like, I have got to see this through and I have to make sure that this industry changes because, well, we'll get into this in a second. I'm sure we'll dive a little bit deeper into what the troubled teen industry is. And there's, I think, a lot of misunderstandings around it, as well as maybe just a complete lack of knowledge on the public level, I think.
Yeah. Absolutely. I agree with that. I mean, I know you're not from Utah. You're from California, which you went to other programs as well. Did you go in Utah?
So I actually went to a program that was in upstate New York, but it was owned by an organization that was from Utah. And yeah. So it's funny because I feel like all the breadcrumbs always lead back to Utah. And I had asked someone. We went to a rally in Provo last fall with Paris as well. And I asked someone there who was local to Utah, I said, do you guys know about this industry? Like, does everyone in Utah just know about this? Because no one else in any other states know about it. And she said, well, I mean, growing up, it was one of those things that we would just see one of these facilities and think, oh, that's one of those schools or that's one of those places. But it was never really a fully known thing to locals. But I'd be interested in hearing your opinion. Is that something in Utah that you guys just know about?
See, that's what was so fascinating to me when I was watching this story, because yes, I've heard about facilities, but I thought that they were pretty much all over. And I would hear about certain celebrities coming to the ones in Utah. So I thought, this is my perception, and I am now realizing how ignorant my perception was, but it was like, oh, it must be some bougie, nice place, right? That's what you think. If you think, oh, Paris Hilton went to this place, so it must be some super nice, posh place where they're getting her lots of help. Seriously, it was so disgusting and like sick to see that that's happening right under people's noses and how just horrifying it really is. What's interesting to me, and this is what I said to my husband and we were talking about, is where those facilities are. They're in the breakup of Utah. You've got the Salt Lake Valley, and then you've got the point of the mountain, and it goes into what is called Happy Valley. Okay. Have you heard this term?
I have not heard this term.
Happy Valley is what it's known as here. It's like known as like this family oriented, you know, super just bubble in the world. And that is smack dab where these facilities are. That's where Provo Canyon is. It's in Happy Valley. Mm. And so that's why to me, I was like, isn't this interesting? This is happening right in the mecca of Happy Valley under everyone's noses. And they don't know. They don't know.
What a paradox. It's so interesting to me. And that's what I actually thought was interesting about this troubled teen industry really originating in Utah. I mean, from what I know of Utah is that it's like family and outdoors and health and, you know, everyone is on the straight and narrow. And so then having these just kind of very gruesomely abusive facilities existing in this state was just such a strange contrast to me. But I love what you mentioned about the boarding school being super posh or really nice. I actually grew up in San Diego, California. And when I was transported to my facility, I had been having some disagreements with my mom. We couldn't see eye to eye on certain things. She wanted to move. I did not want to move. And we were just going back and forth in this argument. She wanted to move out of the country, and I'm like, no way. I live in San Diego. I'm about to start high school. I was 14 at the time, and there was just no way. I dug in my heels. And at the same time, I was also dealing with some depression and anxiety and just trying to figure out myself, right? Like, that's what we go through when we're teenagers. We have to figure out, who am I, right? What do I stand for? What do I like? And you go through all the experiences of like being burned by friends and heartbreak and all the teenage things that we go through to figure out our lives. But I had a transporter take me to the facility in upstate New York. And I was standing in my bedroom getting ready for what I thought was summer camp. And my door flew open. And he must have kicked it in, because I've always kept my door locked. So I know for a fact my door was locked, and it flew open. They told me, you know, you're in our custody now, and you can go the easy way or the hard way, which is like their classic line. You'll hear everyone who tells this transporter story, which is, it makes sense, because there's actually only a few transport companies. And so these people will transport kids from all over the nation into these treatment centers. And so he said that I was in their custody and not to make any sudden movements, and had handcuffs in his hand. And so I knew, like, oh my God, you know, which was really weird, because I was not a combative kid. So I just found this like overbearing, forceful approach to be really shocking. And they told me that they were taking me to boarding school. And so the whole way there, which was like a 2-day trip, I thought that I was going to some bougie, might as well be in college kind of boarding school. I had no idea what I was getting into. I thought, this is going to be great. I'm going to have a dorm room. I'm going to be able to hang out. I'll decorate my room the way I want. And then my mom will send me money and whatever, and I'll just live on my own. Right? I had no idea what I was walking into.
Wow. Tell us a little bit about your experience. I mean, I know your testimony, there was so much packed into that short, powerful testimony, but give us a little bit of an idea what it was you experienced.
Yeah, I will tell you the madness of entering a place like this. So again, I was 14 years old. I didn't do drugs. I wasn't promiscuous. I think I had kissed a boy once. I didn't sneak out. Like, I was relatively minded the rules. I was just a little rebellious when it came to like the music I listened to. My mom didn't like it, and she didn't like the way I dressed. And like, again, I feel like this is very kind of typical teenage behavior, right? I was kind of innocent, to be honest. I didn't have a lot of worldly perspectives. And so when I had these two people fly me across the country, we flew out of San Diego into LaGuardia in New York City, and they handed me off to two other transporters. And I remember these transporters looking really gruff and kind of weathered. And I'm just like, oh, what is this? This is so strange. And but I had high hopes for this school, right? I'm like, oh, this is going to be great. I don't know what it is. I have no idea. But, you know, I'm just going to take whatever life throws at me was kind of my approach to life. So these second set of transporters drove me 6 hours upstate, about just as far upstate New York as you could possibly be. The school was on, I believe it was I-87. It was either 87 or 37. I don't know why my mind's wanting to forget that right now. So it was right there. And then you had one row of houses and then the St. Lawrence River and then Canada. So you could see Canada from the school. We were as far north and as far away from any kind of civilization you can imagine. We were 200 miles from the closest city.
Wow. Okay. And were your transporters men?
So I think they do this intentionally. Looking back, I know that they do. They made sure that there was a man and a woman. Mm-hmm. And to be honest, I mean, they were neither here nor there. Mm-hmm. They weren't really nice to me. They weren't really mean to me. I mean, it was almost like they were just dropping off cargo. Like, here's your package. Do you have to go to the bathroom? No? Good. Let's go. You know, it was just kind of just very short to the point. I don't really remember a whole lot of conversation. I think if anything, I was just maybe a little dissociated in that moment, trying to grasp my whole world, you know, being turned upside down. And we didn't arrive at the facility until it was about 2 or 3 in the morning. And I remember getting there and the campus did not look as glamorous as I had imagined. It was just kind of a single level brick building. And as I looked into the glass doors, you could see just like a long cinder block white hallway with fluorescent lights. And it just looked very sterile. I thought, God, okay, this is maybe not like the vibe that I thought it was going to be. And we had to wait a moment because there was a staff member coming to meet us. And I remember she walked up to the door and she used a badge at this little sensor on the right-hand side of the door that released the doors. They were magnetized shut. And that was the second thing that I was like, huh, magnetized shut doors. Maybe this is not, this is really weird. But I really didn't think much. And what I kind of laugh about this now, because I walked in and I was like, hi, my name's Caroline. Nice to meet you. Like, very bubbly and happy. I had no clue what was going on. And she just could give a care. She was like, yep, come on, get in here. All right, thank you. Took her bags. Yep, we're going to get you over to the dorms. And she was just very gruff and very cold. And essentially, they drove me over to the dormitories where they took me upstairs. Again, very long white cinder block hallways, nothing on the walls, no color. Everything is just kind of this, even an off-white, dingy, yellowy, fluorescent light. No character to the place. And so we get into the bathroom and I remember just how disgusting it looked. And I didn't even want to touch my feet on the ground. And they conducted a strip search on me and they told me to take all my clothes off. I was like, oh my God, okay. And I took my clothes off and they told me to do jumping jacks. And they just kind of watched me. And I just thought, I mean, it's just such a weird feeling being under the microscope like that. And especially because I was so young too. I had never even had an appointment with a gynecologist, nonetheless, being in a situation like that.
Yeah.
Yeah. And they told me to squat and cough. Did that. Didn't know what that was for. I do now. But at the time, I was like, what do you want me to do? And pretty much that night, I slept out on a very thin, 3-inch thick foam mattress out in the hallway on the floor. I learned very quickly that this is not what I thought it was. The rules were very shocking to me. We weren't allowed to even talk at all. And so as soon as I woke up, I saw other girls lining up to go into the bathroom, and they all were silent and looking straight ahead. And so I got up and I said, where do I go? I'm sorry, I'm new. I just got here. I don't know. What do I need to do? And their faces, they looked terrified that I was talking to them. And immediately one of them started waving to a staff member, like frantically, like, and pointing at me, and they weren't talking. And a staff member told me, she was like, oh, you got here overnight. Yeah, you can't talk to anybody. That's hard to get used to. You don't realize how many little things you say, like, oh, excuse me. Oh, thank you. Can you hand me that? You know, just little. Right. And I was getting in trouble all the time for talking because I'm just, we're social creatures. We talk to each other. Yeah. So it was very strange. It was like I had been dropped into a whole nother reality. Insanely structured. The staff, for the most part, were all, I'll say this. It was like they almost enjoyed this game of seeing how far they could push us until we snapped. And then when someone did snap, they would be physically restrained or taken into solitary confinement. So I'm going to back up a little bit, and then we can get into some stories if you're interested. I've got hundreds. But just for so everyone can kind of understand what this program is, when you go in, you start out at level 1, 0 points. And everything is based off of earning points so you can move up in levels. And as you move up in levels, you gain privileges. And eventually, once you complete the program, or what they say is graduate the program, but sometimes people get that confused with graduating high school. Not the same thing. It's graduating their program. Then you get to go home. So your whole life is revolved around trying to earn points and not get any demerits that would take points away. And you could get demerits for anything. You have a flyaway hair, demerit. You accidentally leave your water bottle in the other room, that's a demerit. You look at someone. Yeah. Oh, yeah.
You look at someone.
If I were to, and listen to this, if I were to make eye contact with someone and make a facial expression, like lift my eyebrows or even smile, like acknowledging that person, they would consider that to be run plans. Like I was planning to run away with this person. And you would literally have to start your program over again. No matter how many levels you had, how many points you had, you would start all over. No matter how long you'd been there, you could be there for a year. And they say, oh, yeah, now you have this demerit and you have to start over.
Wow. So you'd have to, you wouldn't just dock points. You would have to start over at 0.
For that infraction.
Oh, I see. I see. So for looking at someone and smiling or raising your eyebrows, you would have to start over.
And it depends. Here's another aspect of it, too. If you can imagine being a kid and trying to sort out all of this madness, it depends on the staff member. Mm-hmm. If it was a staff member that was nice, they may not say anything, or they could give you a lesser infraction. But when I first got there, which it actually changed a little bit because they were investigated by the state of New York for child abuse. And so they decided to change some of their rules as they went through this investigation. So that changed a little bit over time, where things like that wouldn't have necessarily been punished so harshly. But when I first got there, if you glanced out of a window, I mean, and I'm not saying staring out the window, if your eyes just diverted ever so slightly towards a window, that was considered run plans, and you would also start your program all over again.
Wow. So I've talked to people, I've talked to adults that have gone to prison. They've been in prison for years and we've had deep convos. This is worse than prison because this isn't even like in prison, you don't get in trouble for these kinds of things. You don't get in trouble for looking that way or looking at someone in the eyes or talking to someone. It's worse than prison for these children. This is insanity on such a level. One of the things that you said in your testimony that was so compelling to me is I want you to kind of speak to this part where they would tell you that if you tried to run, that you could tell them what would happen.
So keep in mind, this facility, like I mentioned, was 200 miles from any major city. And we were right across from Canada, but even once you get into Canada after swimming across the St. Lawrence River, what do? So we were really isolated. Staff members were always on watch for anyone trying to run. And being a student there, or if you want to call it a student, I don't even like that saying student in this context, because that's not really what we were, but a resident there, I guess, you were encouraged to make sure that no one else ran away either. And so we had a staff member who would tell us all the time, and she would have this grin on her face as she told us she loved it. She would say, if you try to run, we're going to break your legs. And if you see anyone else run, you better run after them and break their legs or I'm breaking yours. And we had no reason to doubt her. When you live in that environment, seeing kids be physically restrained is a really common occurrence. And so that really puts the fear in you, right? You see your friend screaming, crying as staff members are on top of them. And you're like, oh my God, I never wanted to go through something like that. So yeah, they threatened us that they would break our legs if we tried to run away. We were also told many times, they had a bunch of different stories they would tell us. One of them was the neighbors knew who we were, all the people in that town who lived around there, and they would not hesitate to shoot us if they saw us. We were told if we ran out into the woods that there were wild hogs and turkey buzzards that would attack us. You know, all those things. And so as a kid, you're like, all right, I'm 14. I'm stuck in this facility. If I try to run, I'm either going to be attacked by a wild animal or shot by a neighbor or my legs broken by everybody else in the facility chasing after me, which is not a fun feeling, you know, that there's, oh gosh, 150 to 200 girls at any point in time who would be chasing you down is terrifying. And so something else on top of that, I do get a lot of people who ask me, why didn't you tell your mom that this stuff was going on? And I want to say, just so everyone really understands kind of what a powerless situation this is, whenever these kids, and even to this day, when kids are admitted to these programs, the parent is told immediately, I mean, even prior to admission, your child's going to lie about this place. They're going to try to manipulate you and tell you anything to get home. Don't believe them. They are manipulating you. They are lying to you. Okay, so the parent's already primed to not believe the kid. And then they also say, you know, you parented your child and this is what's happened is that now they're in our facility and you need to trust us to be able to do something different to make sure that they're successful and they're happy, right? So the parents are already not believing us. And then on top of that, we had to earn phone calls with our parents. And so I was there for, I want to say, almost 12 months before I had a phone call with my mom.
Wow, really? And you were there for a total of 29 months?
29 months, 2.5 years.
Wow.
Of being in this facility. I really thought, and I know this sounds dramatic, but in that moment, like you forget what it's like to be normal. You forget what it's like to just talk and go outside and listen to music when you want to and things like that. You really kind of forget what that's like. And so I thought I was going to be there until I was like 40. I never thought I was going to leave that place. Yeah. I mean, wow. Realistically, you know, you can leave when you turn 18. I was 14. So that seemed like a really long time away, but I never thought I was going to get out of there I mean, it just seemed to stretch on and on and on forever.
So why did it take you? Because I've listened to other people as well. Like, I think Paris was there for what, like 13 months or 12 months or something like that. And then some other people, like it's all different. And I know she was in a different facility. But why 29 months? Like that seems like a very long time. Were you getting in trouble according to what they said? I mean, what was going on there?
So what's funny is, and I actually know about this in hindsight, I've been able to see some documents that let me know this is actually what was happening. At the time, I didn't understand. So once you reach level 4, right, there's 6 levels. And so once you reach the 6th level and you graduate, they make you go through different kinds of seminars and self-help things. And once you complete all of those and you reach level 6, you can finally go home. And so levels 4 through 6 is known as upper level phase. And you actually don't have to walk in line anymore. On the lower levels, you have to walk in like a military style line with the rest of the girls that are in your group. And so, I mean, it was a huge privilege to not have to walk in line, and you could actually talk, which was cool, which just sounds so ironic saying that now. But at the time, like, that's what you wanted. You wanted to be able to have like normal human privileges. So if you are on upper levels and you are to receive a certain kind of demerit, that demerit means that you then have to go back in line with your family. And you go on something, what they call it, probation. So there's certain levels, and everything's a level within this school. So I'm going to try to explain this as simply as possible. So with demerits, you have, again, 5 different levels for demerits. So you have what they call a category 1, and you would lose 10 points. A category 2, you would lose 25. A category 3, you would lose 50. In category 4, you're losing all your points and 2 levels. Category 5, you're losing all your levels and you're starting completely over. I wanted to add that you can only earn about 12 points a day. Okay, so you can only earn 12 points a day. So if you get a 25-point demerit, which is really easy to do, again, you leave your water bottle in the other room, that's 25 points. That's 2 days. Right? That's a really long time. And so it's really emotional when you end up getting demerits for stupid things because you're like, oh my God, now I'm going to be here even longer. So what ended up happening with me, why I was there for so long, I kept being put on probation as an upper level. So I was finally almost making my way ready to go home. And then I remember one time your initials are supposed to be written on everything. And my initials were smeared on something. It was plastic, so it's natural to think over time a Sharpie marker is going to get, you know, rubbed or smeared. My initials were smeared, and they considered that an illegal item. And so I then earned a 50-point demerit, got dropped down onto probation in a family, put back on lower levels, and it took me about a month and a half to get back up to the upper level status. I went on probation more times than anybody. I was constantly on probation for dumb stuff, really dumb stuff. And what I learned afterwards, and this is what I was trying to get to, is that they would specifically target students who they knew that their parents were going to continue to shell out money, and they would intentionally find things to either bump them down on probation, keep them there longer. And that is because the staff there got commission. For each child that was there, they got monthly commission for each child that was there.
Wow.
Like, yeah. Oh, it's horrible.
Yeah. Cause I remember you saying, or somewhere I heard that they receive like $16,000 a month for each kid. Who can pay that? Who can pay $16,000 a month for that long? It's so unbelievable that this has been able to be kept under wraps for so long. So I wonder this. So I get like, when you're in the facility, that when you would like call your mom, they would school you on what to say, or they would tell you. And I'm sure you were terrified. I mean, as a 14-year-old child, that's so scary. All of these things that you're hearing, it makes sense to me that you would just try to play their game and play nice and get the hell out of there as soon as you could. But this is what I really wonder, though. What about afterwards when kids get home? Like when you get home or Paris gets home or any of these other kids get home, you would think that they would tell their parents and then parents would raise hell. What about that? Like what happened with you when you got home?
I love that you're bringing this up. This is excellent. You would think that was the case, but a lot of these programs are actually accused of brainwashing. And I'm about to tell you why. It's because over and over and over and over again, when you're in the program, you are taught that if you speak against the program, you are bad. You will stay here longer. You are not working the program, is what they would say. You're not working the program. If you're speaking negatively, you will fail out in the real world, right? They're like equating all of this stuff to like program loyalty, which is actually really interesting because you see a lot of this same kind of indoctrination in cults.
Yeah, right? That's what it sounds like to me, as a cult. It's not a school. It's a literally straight up cult, right? It's what it sounds like.
And anyone listening, look up Synanon, and it's spelled S-Y-N-A-N-O-N, Synanon. And that is one of the most violent cults in America. And that group is actually what gave birth to this industry. There's so many levels to this.
Girl, I like think of when you guys are like sleeping, that they're like playing these things in the night in your subconscious of like, don't ever tell anyone about us, or, you know, like that subconscious programming. I mean, it's unbelievable.
Oh, totally. And then the parents are taught the same thing, right? So the parents have their own indoctrination and they go through these seminars where they make you do just kind of some bizarre things. And I actually had the privilege of interviewing a woman by the name of Rachel Bernstein. And she was actually in the documentary Seduced that was talking about Nexium, the Nexium cult that came out. And she is a cult recovery specialist. So we were talking about kind of the similarities between the programs and the troubled teen industry and cults. And I was telling her, they would make us do something called a confession letter. Everyone had to do it when you got there. You would write this long confession letter and it would be anything that you ever did wrong. Anything. You're like, one time the cashier gave me a dollar extra and I kept it. And I walked out with that dollar. Another time, I mean, I'm so serious about this. Like one time I lied and said that I, you know, whatever, like you, yeah. Anything that you had ever done, right? Night I snuck out, mom, or I was on the phone with Bobby after you told me not to be on the phone with Bobby. And so what would happen is the staff there would forward this letter to your parents. And a lot of times they would come back and say, that's not good enough. And they'd rip it up. And you had written like 12 or 20 pages of confessions. They'd rip it up and they'd say, that's not good enough. You're lying. You're not telling the whole truth. You're not ready to go home. You're not taking this seriously. And so you would start to embellish, because that's what you do. You're like, well, I told the truth and that wasn't good enough. You would literally have kids who had never tried drugs say, I was really addicted to cocaine, mom and dad. I'm so happy you sent me here. I really needed this help. So then what they would do, the staff would give these to the parents and say, see, you made the right choice. She needed to be here. He needed to be here. And then on the other side of that, they would make the parents write something called a commitment letter, which is pretty much their commitment to the child completing the program, and they're not going to stand for the child's manipulation anymore and blah, blah, blah. You know, all this tough love kind of language. So psychologically, what that does to you is you learn, okay, I've got to conform. I've got to conform. I've got to comply. And so after a long time, you start to really believe these kinds of indoctrination that they're feeding you, right? I was a bad kid. I deserved it. How do I know that? Because look at my confession letter. It says all these horrible things about me. And you start to believe that the program saved my life. I needed it. I'm a better person because of this.
Yeah. So you were there for 2.5 years. So you get out at like 16 and a half or 17 years old, right? How old are you now, if I can ask?
Yeah, I'm 30 now.
Okay. So you're 30 now. And so what happened when you got out? Did you go back? And were you able to, like, how was your relationship with your parents? Do you talk to your parents now? And you talk about your mom. Was your dad around? How is that?
Okay, so I will tell you all the details. So my mom and I do have a really great relationship now. Actually, through my activism, we've been able to have a lot of really important conversations that we've needed to have for a long time. And my mom had always been my best friend. Always. I mean, maybe we were even too much of friends and didn't really have that mother-daughter relationship. I mean, we did. Don't get me wrong. We absolutely did. But we were just really good friends. We loved spending time together. We'd laugh together. And my dad actually wasn't really a part of my life at this point. He and I are very close now, but at that time, I just really didn't have that relationship. One time, so if this can give you the amount of culture shock or an idea of the culture shock that coming out of this program was like, one time they took me to a doctor's appointment, which, by the way, was the only doctor's appointment I ever went on the entire time I was there. So I just want to be clear. It's not like we were, you know, receiving all kinds of medical treatment. We really weren't. But they were taking me to a doctor's appointment and they loaded me up in this white van and two staff members were driving me to this appointment. And I remember driving through this little town and I hadn't been outside of the facility in about, I want to say it was about 16 months. I had spent just in that building, did not leave, could not go outside.
They don't let you go outside.
Remember when I said they started changing things after a while because they were being investigated? So then they eventually started letting us go outside. But even when they did, it was usually within some kind of gated area. And it wasn't just like, oh, yeah, go take a walk, come back in 20 minutes. Like, it was not like that. You were always monitored. There was never a time that you weren't being watched. But I remember driving through this little town and I was so fascinated. I'm like, oh, my God, look at those little houses. And there's someone like this is life is continuing on out here without me. And I was just so fascinated. I remember seeing someone walking down to their mailbox and getting their mail. And I was like, oh, that's adorable. Look at them just living, you know. But really what happened is after being institutionalized for that long, I became incredibly detached from the world. And after not talking for so long or interacting with people for so long, especially during those key developmental years, once I got out of the program, I had severe social anxiety. I do have chronic PTSD from those experiences. I didn't know how to function. I didn't know how to just talk to people, or I never felt safe. I never felt like I could relax because I hadn't relaxed in 2.5 years. And so really what that led to, and I'll share this just very briefly, I ended up developing an addiction. And I went through addiction very, very severely for about 7 years. That was the only time that I felt like I could relax enough to talk to people or to socialize or to think about something else other than that my like crushing anxiety and fear. Sometimes people ask me if I feel like I got anything good out of the program. I honestly, and I know like any survivors are probably going to come for me from saying this, but anything good that I got out of the program, which I do think I got some things out of it, was not by any means what the program intended to teach me. What I got out of it was learning that I'm an incredibly strong person to mentally survive something like that. I learned that I can make it through anything. I made it through 2.5 years of that hell. You know, that's what I got out of it. It was nothing the program actually taught. Necessarily need to put kids through like horrifyingly traumatic experiences to learn those things about themselves. Life is hard enough. We don't need to make things harder.
Oh, absolutely. Absolutely. So, I mean, it makes so much sense to me that you would want to just escape your mind, escape your anxiety. I watched the documentary that Paris did and watched how much her experience had affected her as far as her insomnia, not being able to, you know, to relax. and have that peace. And so I can imagine that that is probably for everybody that goes through this experience. And so, yeah, addiction sounds like it would be something very normal. I'm sure a lot of people that go through these programs experience addiction.
Absolutely. There is actually a very large number of addicts, or I don't even like saying addicts because I feel like there's a stigma with that. But yeah, there's people who come out of these programs and they don't know how to deal with life. Actually, these programs are having the exact opposite effect that they claim to have. Kids don't know how to function in the world after they get out of these places. The family is fragmented because they're resentful of their parents. And it creates, you know, if anyone's familiar with attachment theory, sometimes it's called like attachment parenting, where you focus on creating a really solid bond, connected bond between you and your kids. And so that child will have a really solid foundation as they go out into the world, right? They will feel safe. They will feel confident. They always have their family to fall back on. And after going through that separation from your family for so long, what you actually learn is I can't trust anybody and I only have myself. And that has been a continuous battle throughout my life to be like, Caroline, let people help, let people in, trust them. You don't have to do everything on your own. And that's still a work in progress, but I have come a long way with that.
Yeah. Wow. I can imagine that that would be so, so hard. I mean, I didn't even go through near what you have gone through with the trauma, but my husband and I, we were just saying the other day that, you know, finding trust in each other has been such a huge thing because it's something we've both struggled with for our entire life, you know, really trusting other people. So that's, I'm sure, such a huge, huge thing when you feel like maybe you were even betrayed by your family or your parents that, you know, they sent you away when you weren't being perfect. You weren't being a perfect kid, right? Which it sounds like you were pretty close. It doesn't sound like you were a very, you know, bad kid or anything. So what would your advice be to parents that are at their wit's end and they're afraid for their children or they don't know what to do? And they're just like, I don't know. What's your advice for them?
So this is definitely a question we get a lot because I have had people come back with, well, what about a teenager who's running away and stealing cars and getting involved in all of this other stuff? And here's the thing is that no child ends up there by themselves. And there's always a family dynamic. There is always, from what I've seen, some kind of trauma. And I don't want to generalize because I know someone's going to come back and say, well, no, this kid had a perfect life and they turned out, you know, whatever. But that's just not how it works. I think a lot of times parents don't want to look at themselves and they don't want to look at how they maybe contributed to this issue. And I'm not about mom shaming. I'm not a perfect parent. I have a 7-year-old. I'm not a perfect parent. However, I'm willing to look at myself. I'm willing to say, how could I be better? How could I do better? I also think that no one is going to love your kid more than you do. No one. And sending them out to a place with complete strangers, they do not care about your child like you. And therefore, you are the most qualified to guide them through life. And you have their best interests in mind compared to these people who, quite honestly, see your kid as a paycheck or see your kid as a number, right? They're like, all right, number 17, get in here, get your medication, go eat, right? That's just kind of the culture of these places. So if you do find yourself in a situation with your kids where you feel like we could use outside help or maybe you're feeling desperate, first off, chill out. Don't freak out. Don't panic. Your mind's going to want to take you to, oh my God, what if they die? What if this happens? And there's going to be a lot of predatory, troubled teen industry programs that are going to feed off of that desperation and fear. And they're going to say, oh yeah, your child could die. You're right. You better do something now. Sign a check today and we'll make sure that everything's fine. And they're capitalizing on that fear. Get your own feelings in check. How much of this is reality? How much of this is fear? Teenage years are not perfectly mapped out. Kids are going to make mistakes. That's the point of being a teenager. They're impulsive. Their brains aren't fully developed, right? They're figuring out life and they're kind of in these bigger people bodies at that age. So I encourage you to loop in a really good therapist. Do your research on therapists. Don't just go to anybody that your insurance accepts or anyone that you find first on Google. I mean, really do your research. I'm like, if you need help with that too, contact me. I am excellent at finding really, really good therapists. You want someone who can deal specifically and is an expert specifically in your child's, you know, unique issues. Be resourceful. Even if you need a break from your kid, send them to a family member's house for a week so you can get yourself together before making rash decisions. And if you do feel like inpatient is necessary, look for an inpatient psychiatric hospital. If that's what is going on with your child, look at the reviews, Google your heart out, do your research. Don't just blindly send your kids somewhere because they have a fancy website and there's a consultant telling you that that's the right choice. Do your research.
Yes. Wow. I love that. Such wise advice. It's so true, though, when you say, you know, be willing to look at yourself. I do coaching, and sometimes I'll get parents that have not coached with me, and they'll say, hey, you know, I heard about you, and I want to see if you'll work with my child. And my first thought is always, and this is what I say to them, well, what's going on with you? Oh, not so fast. You get back here, mom or dad. What's going on with you? Because, and I get, you know I was raised with 8 siblings. I understand that some kids are more challenging than others, and there's things that happen to children. I've seen very traumatic things happen to children, and then they start acting out, such as them being raped or sexually abused. And then they start acting out, and parents don't know that that's why they're acting out. And it's like they get labeled as this hellion, and then they're sent off, or they're the last thing they need is a cold shoulder and the back turned on them. They need embrace. They need love. They need understanding. They need support and protection. But I think so many times, you know, parents are the umbrella. And so many times if a child is really wound up or they're really struggling with certain things, they're picking up. I'm not saying it's always the parent's fault, but like you said, I think you hit it right on the head when you said, well, be willing to first like look within and go, you know, what am I doing? I agree. I'm not a perfect parent either. I have 4 children and my oldest is 23. So I've gone through, you know, all the stages. There have been many mistakes that every parent makes along the way, but I just can't imagine that being the answer to send them off to strangers. And I love what you said about how no one will care more about your child than you do. No one.
Yeah. I mean, that's just true. The truth of it. No one knows them as intricately as you do. And, you know, my son, he's 7 now. And especially when he was younger, his behavior has improved substantially, but we have our moments. But he was just a really fiery little kid and really demanding. And just like, I mean, if he was throwing a tantrum, would not get tired. Would not get tired. I mean, he could go on for hours. And I had to do some of the deepest soul searching of my life because I did all the textbook stuff, right? I did the textbook parenting stuff. You give them a reward. If they misbehave, you put them in timeout, right? And I was consistent as hell, right? People say like, oh, well, it must be the parent. You're not being consistent. No, I was so psycho consistent. Did not work. Did not work. And so I had to take a step back and say like, okay, I have got to quit parenting like how I think I should parent, and I need to parent how he needs me to parent. And so then I started looking for cues, right? How does he actually need me to parent him? What is he looking for right now? And I think with kids, we have this idea that they just need to be compliant, right? They need to comply constantly. They got to follow our orders. And if they don't follow, and what it really is that we are afraid to be bad parents if they don't comply. And so we don't want to live with that shame of being a bad parent by having a kid that doesn't listen. And so a lot of times people will, you know, scream at their kids or be physically intimidating. And to me, it's actually not even about the kid. It's about the parent. You know, even in my kid would throw wild tantrums when he was little. And I remember us being in a grocery store one time. And, you know, the soda aisles that have the like boxes of like eight or 12 cans of soda. And they're like piled up like a wall of soda for that whole aisle. He had crawled back behind the soda and was literally in the middle of the aisle behind the soda wall, screaming, throwing a tantrum. And I'm on the other side, like yelling at this wall of soda, like, you need to get out of there right now. Get out. I'm done. And I see people walking by, like looking at me. And, you know, in that moment, I realized, I was like, what am I stressed about? He's upset. He's behind the soda wall. What? Who cares? It's okay. Like, you know, how could I approach this in a relaxed way? I could pull a few things of soda out and be like, hey, dude, what are you doing? And so I think that we've got to let go of that idea of being a perfect parent or what other people think being a perfect parent is. We got to let our kids be kids and our teenagers be teenagers. It's a part of life.
Yeah, absolutely. I love that so much. So you have obviously done a lot of healing. I know that you do spiritual work now. You tell me a little about how you healed and what you do before we end here today.
Yeah. So I actually started meditating, doing yoga when I was a kid. I grew up in California. So I feel like that's a prerequisite to growing up in California is you get kind of exposed to that culture. I will say that while I was in the program, is when I really started getting serious about my search for meaning and my purpose and connection to God, source, energy, the universe, because I had nothing else, right? That was all I had. I couldn't talk. There was no TV, no music, no, you know, socializing or anything. So I just had this very deep inward journey. And I really think that that's what kept me going through that entire time. But even afterwards, going through addiction and recovery, and the spiritual journey is interesting because it's always like this path of rediscovery. So it's like trailblazing and this path of rediscovery as you kind of relearn a lot of the same things in different contexts throughout your path. I have a very serious chakra practice and very serious meditation practice. I also practice manifestation and law of attraction and all of those fun things. And for me, the trauma healing has been the most profound work, because in kind of relating back to chakra work, that's what allowed me to really identify this trauma, because I could feel it in my body then. And I could feel where certain energy centers of my body, I just wasn't connected with at all. I didn't know what a root chakra felt like. Had no idea. I was so disconnected. What does that feel like? I have no idea. I was all up in my upper chakras, like crazy anxiety, energy all over the place. And I wasn't tuning into my heart. First off was another one. Took a lot of time to open my solar plexus, because, you know, we know our, for anyone listening, our solar plexus is our sunshine. It is our confidence, our radiance, our charisma. It is our outward essence. And so being in a lockdown facility where you couldn't express, you couldn't be confident, you couldn't have any of that, my solar plexus was super shut down and disconnected. So it is a process. I still struggle with anxiety. I still struggle with my PTSD. But the difference is now I'm willing to face it, and I've also got the tools to be able to deal. You know, I think it's just a matter of grace. Be graceful with yourself. I think when we do struggle with certain mental health issues, there's this tendency to be, you want to be anywhere but in your own mind, right? Oh, I'm going through depression. I just want to be anywhere but here. If I could just not feel this way, and we resist it and we fight it. And it's like, you know, what we resist will persist. So if we can learn to love that version of ourselves also and show that grace and mercy to ourselves when we are feeling afraid or anxious, or depressed or not like ourselves. I will share one more thing on that. When I really started facing a lot of my trauma with this program, I had gone to my mom's house and there was a bunch of stuff coming out online about the program I went to in particular. So that's when I started learning about staff members earning commission. And I started getting really angry. I'm like, my life, that was my life that people took from me for a paycheck. And it disgusted me. And I went through all the emotions, right? Like the rage, the heartache, the pity for myself, all the things. I went to my mom's house and she had a box up in storage that had all of my letters from the program, all of my journals, every single scrap of paper from this place I had saved. And I spent a week going through everything. And when I tell you, I went through a PTSD relapse, which is, and it can present differently for everyone. But for me, I literally reverted back to being 14. I felt like a kid. I felt like I was back there. And as uncomfortable as that was, I think that that's what really, really, really triggered my ability to start healing. Start healing that 14-year-old that was inside me hurting still.
Yes. Wow. Oh, I look at the game of life in three phases. We come here to forget who we are, then remember who we are, and then turn around and help others remember who they are. And I think about it like in the Titanic, you know, when they're going down, the ship's gone down, people are out flailing around in the water. They don't know they're going to be okay. They're scared. That's phase one. Phase two is where you get out of the boat and you're like, okay, I know I'm going to be okay. Right. And then phase three is where you turn around, you start helping other people out. You now are turning around and really putting yourself out there and doing the work to pay it forward and help other people. And I think it's so encouraging and beautiful and inspiring to see that. And I love it. I love to see what you're doing. And you're a brave warrior soul, my dear.
Thank you. Helping people is the only way that I can justify those experiences. And you know, I was just telling my boyfriend the other day that like everything that I do in my life, I have to feel led to do it. And if we live in that space of being led and being of service, you can have an incredibly rewarding life. And these are the things I know about, and this is my expertise. And so if I can help other people, then that makes the pain and suffering I went through have value, right? It's like, oh, okay, maybe that's not something that's like deep and shameful about myself. This is, can actually be a really valuable quality about me. And same goes for anyone out there with any kind of trauma you've been through. If that's what you seek to do with it, it can be your best asset instead of something that's so heavy and dark on your soul. But thank you so much for allowing me to dive into that journey. And I hope for people listening, you guys got something out of that. And I'm definitely open to any communications. You guys are more than welcome to reach me. I will give my email to Jen, and you can reach me at policy@breakingcodesilence.net. I love to talk to people. So give me, I will tell you this though, I am wildly busy. So it may take me a day or so to get back to you, but I promise, promise, promise I will.
I love that. My last question, aside from how we can find you, is what is your message to the world?
My message to the world. Okay. My message to the world is that you have the power to change anything. You are the creator. Anything that you desire, whether it's fame, fortune, helping people, starting a nonprofit, healing, maybe it's just getting on your feet. Maybe you just want to feel better, right? Whatever that is, you have absolutely everything that you need inside of you. And the answer is never on the outside. It's never external. You absolutely have everything inside of you that you need.
I love it. That's beautiful. Perfect. That's mic drop. So Caroline has a podcast that you can listen to on all major platforms, right? You're on Apple, Spotify. It's called Inside the Program.
Yes, yes. And I actually have another podcast too called Divine Reclamation. And this is a podcast that I had before inside the program that's mostly around like spiritual growth and self-development and business and attracting wealth. And so if that is your cup of tea, also definitely check out both of them. Inside the program is obviously about the program, and it is heavy and it is graphic. So I will say I cuss on it. Other people cuss on it. It's explicit. But trigger warning before you go listen, for sure. Make sure you're in a good headspace to hear some of it.
Yeah. Yeah. You're keeping it real. I love that you've got like the more high vibration, lighter stuff, but you're also facing the shadow on the other side of the things that need to have the light shined on. So that's good. You're right. Those are very different from each other, aren't they? Wow.
Polar opposites. Yeah. Go. So if after you listen to Inside the Program, go listen to Divine Reclamation so you feel better.
Do a little chakra clearing. I love it. That's awesome. Well, you are truly living your calling and you are a gift to the world. So on behalf of the children in the teen troubled troubled teen industry and all the youth, parents, and the human race, my dear, we thank you. We thank you for your bravery, and thanks for being here and sharing your powerful message.
Well, thank you so much, Jen. I've thoroughly enjoyed it. And we'll talk later. You are going to come onto my podcast at some point. And thank you. Thank you for having me here.
Awesome. All right, my dear. Thank you, everyone, for joining us today, and have a fabulous week. I will see you next week. Bye for now. Do you have a coach? I would love to take this journey with you to dive deep and start to shift those areas to create a life that truly honors you. I'll meet you on that bridge at whatever level you are ready, with either group or one-on-one coaching. You can check out my programs at jensuliafu.com/programs. Also, go ahead and hit that subscribe button and rate and review this show and give me your feedback. Also, please share this with your friends and family and be a lighthouse out in the world. Thanks for joining me.